And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Want to be a great nature photographer? You and about 16.2 million others, and maybe even more than that. There's a lot to it, and today we go in depth with Jeff Mitchum, whose expertise took him around the world with National Geographic, and who continues his worldwide quest for the interesting, the sublime, and the magical. If you've ever dreamed of being a professional nature photographer, we're about to focus in on the life of a pro when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Imagine, if you'd like, what it would be like to make your living traveling around the world to some of the most exotic, remote, and breathtaking places, and being paid to seek out the interesting, the intricate, the powerful, and serene, and capture it all on film. The life of a professional nature photographer is filled with adventure, mystery, and romance. But the truth is, only a handful ever really have the skills, determination, and whatever else it takes to become one of the best. But today, we're going in depth with one of the top nature photographers. Jeff Mitchum discusses how he got started, what it takes to be a top-tier nature photographer, shares some of his secrets and adventures. He's not only got a great eye, he also has an ability to share his perceptions with clarity and a great sharing of spirit. There's a lot of insights, no matter what your level of interest in photography may be. So following today's news, Jeff tells you what you need to know to become a great nature photographer. But first, the news. With names like Alcoa, General Electric, and DuPont, you don't generally think of environmental advocacy. Well, that was then, and this is now. This week, 10 of America's largest and most noted companies, representing power companies, manufacturers, petroleum, chemicals, and financial services, called for an immediate response from all sectors to place a nationwide limit on carbon dioxide emissions in order to bring CO2 levels down 10 to 30% over the next 15 years. Sitting in a massive dais, along with presidents of the World Resources Institute, Environmental Defense, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, were the presidents of Alcoa, GE, and DuPont, as already stated, and Caterpillar, Duke Energy, Pacific Gas and Electric, Florida Power and Light, PNM of New Mexico, BP, and Lehman Brothers. Peter A. Darby, CEO of PG&E, summed up the event. "My hope and expectation is that Congress, the White House, and the public will look at these chief executives and note that companies with a motive to oppose emissions controls are nonetheless saying, here's a serious problem, it needs to be dealt with. And it needs to be dealt with now." The group is advocating the establishment of a nationwide carbon credit trading system, which allows companies which utilize or institute carbon-efficient systems to sell those credits to companies which exceed the mandatory limits imposed by the system, thus encouraging the transition to clean energy systems as an economic incentive. The group, loosely referred to as the United States Climate Action Partnership, held its briefing on Monday, the day before the President's State of the Union address. Participants agreed that the timing was definitely chosen to send a clear message that business and industry needs leadership from Congress and the White House to stave off more stringent and disruptive measures that could result if actions are not taken now, actions which most believe could lessen the ultimate impact of global warming on the world economy. Overall wind power generation is expected to increase in the United States by 27% in 2007, following a similar increase in 2006. In 2006, $4 billion were invested to produce 2,454 megawatts of new wind-generating capacity. Each megawatt is estimated to provide power to 200 to 300 homes. Texas is currently the largest wind power generator, followed by California. Wind power is a nearly carbon-neutral source of power, and is one industry that will benefit from the cap-and-trade system discussed in the previous news item. Many experts are predicting that polar bears will be one of the first major mammal species to be directly impacted by the effects of global warming. Polar bears, which spend much of their lives on sea ice, are having to adapt to the dramatic decrease in the sea ice. One of the most direct indicators comes from pregnant polar bears, which traditionally dig birthing dens on the polar ice. Between 1985 and 1994, 62% of pregnant females birthed on sea ice. However, between 1998 and 2004, only 37% birthed on sea ice, with the majority changing their birthing dens to land. This is an indicator that animals like the polar bear will make efforts to adapt to changing conditions as global warming proceeds. The U.S. Navy has received a 2-year extension on their exemption from regulations that prohibit the use of sonar in their training and exercises. Researchers and scientists have sued the Navy, claiming such massive underwater concussions can injure, damage, and even kill large mammals, including whales. The exemption permits such military sonar without having to seek permission under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. If regulations were in place, the Navy would have to apply for each individual event. The Navy claims it takes precautions to prevent injuring whales by utilizing lookouts who attempt to spot evidence of any whales in the vicinity. The Navy plans to proceed with at least 40 such exercises in the next 2 years. A recent study reports that waterbird populations are in general decline worldwide. 44% of the 900 species studied showed declines in the past 5 years, while the rest were stable or increasing. The worst decreases occurred in Asia, as 62% of waterbird populations have declined or become extinct. The most frequent cause of waterbird decline is habitat destruction, as coastal areas are being cleared for development generally around the world. And again in Asia, the rising demand for live reef fish by the Chinese people has decimated endangered species around Asia. The depletion directly correlates with rising economic growth, as catches of species such as groupers have declined 99% in the last 5 years, coinciding with the rapid economic growth of countries where exotic fish are a delicacy. And finally, unusually warm temperatures are bringing African and Mediterranean butterflies into the Austrian Alps in the dead of winter. Along with the butterflies, almond and primrose trees are budding at a time which normally would find these trees absolutely dormant. And with the warm temperatures, bears and hedgehogs, usually gone dormant for the winter months in these regions, are rummaging around and forsaking their usual winter sleep. And certain birds, such as geese and cranes, are heading north, figuring that spring is in the air. The one conclusion to be drawn from the stories of animals adapting to the changing conditions is that we may just have to do the same. That is, if we can compete with the mind of a butterfly. And that's the news. And a reminder, too, if you're a new listener to the Wild Side News, I'd love to hear from you. Send me an email and let me know how you found the show, what you like, some show ideas. You can send your comments to me at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. Thanks. And now, we bring you a full hour as we go in-depth with one of the world's leading nature photographers, Jeff Mitchum.
Well, I think as everybody knows, I'm a person who is totally fascinated with the wonder. That also translates as the beauty that we see in this extraordinary planet, and as well the miraculous nature of the creatures, the wild creatures. They thrill me as they thrill so many people. I'm sitting in the studio of someone who is a very fortunate guy, hardworking. He has an opportunity to literally go out into nature and spend real time, because what he does is he takes his cameras out there and creates some extraordinary images, and has been very successful with this. And I want to welcome to the Wild Side News, Jeff Mitchum. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Sydney. It's great to have you, and welcome to Mikasa.
Yeah. We both share space here in the San Diego area, and so this is a rare opportunity for me to actually sit with one of my guests and have a conversation. You're a photographer. You like to work with film and you like to work with... Your presentations are very large format pieces that are truly extraordinary. Let's first of all start talking about how in the world you got started as a photographer.
For me, it was when I was about 12. My dad was an avid hunter. And when we went out during opening season for pheasants, and then later for deer, I just asked my dad the question, why? I don't like the meat. I said, I prefer chicken, and I prefer fish and cow if I have to do something. But I said, I just don't understand why I would want to shoot something that I don't want to eat. And there's no need to shoot them. And, and so then he gave me a camera. And he said, you're right. And eventually that led to my dad getting out of hunting, that one question. So from there, that's where my photography began to take on its own personality and its own charm. And as I see things, through nature, with the camera lens. And that was really like the beginning of where my photography started. My dad introducing me to the outdoors through hunting, and then that light clicking on, that I don't have to go outdoors and shoot something. I can go outdoors, see it, capture it, and let it walk away, leave it alive, leave it in a better condition, hopefully.
So where did you grow up?
Grew up in California, born, raised here in Southern California, on the beach, surfing. That was pretty much my protocol growing up, in the swimming pool, and that would be at 4 a.m. swim workouts, then at 6 o'clock, surfing Huntington Beach Pier, in school by 8, and that was the rough life that I had to live. Which is interesting because of the, that was my other connection to photography is, I came to understand early morning light through surfing and watching the sun, and which brings so many people to the beach, is just watching sunrises, and then you start seeing the color shift and the patterns in the ocean and the warmer light temperatures, things that are really essential to understanding, just going really strong with your photography.
So the question would be, although you started photographing at 12, even before that, did you find yourself, somehow nature spoke to you in a special ways that perhaps it didn't with others?
Pretty much it was just a thing that I realized I was seeing things with the camera and interpreting nature in a unique way, in a different way, as I would be pointing things out to people and identifying and, possibly going macro with it, that other people would just be walking by. And so I started thinking, I'm seeing things differently than the way that these other people are seeing it. And so that kind of opened up my ideas, and then it started, bringing me full circle around to, understanding that what I see with the camera is the same thing that people see in their minds when they write. And not being a great writer, I can barely write my name, but I thought, okay, what they capture in words, which mesmerizes me, I look at how people write and how proficient, prolific, you realize they've got the master's touch. Then I realize I'm doing the same thing, only with film. I'm capturing the way I see it.
So in those early years with your camera, what were you shooting with? We're not going to go real technical here, but photography is quite an involved process, particularly before digital. Mm-hmm. So just some of the details, because if you're trying to do macro work, you have to have some special lenses. Were you privileged to have access to some of that?
Yeah, the first one is those disposable cameras. That's what my dad gave me. He didn't give me a 600-millimeter lens and say go out and knock them dead and drop a small king's ransom. But it was just a point-and-shoot camera. And then from there, I learned to get close. And because you had to get close with those, and then you had to have a lot of light working with wildlife. So, I learned a lot of the temperaments of photography by, just having a disposable camera getting close.
Well, you've just made some great big points with me, because Huntington Beach, it's a nice upscale community in many respects, at least it is right now. And so I was kind of imagining when you said your dad went out and got you a camera, that he went out and pulled off a Nikon with some great lenses. And so now the fact that you actually started out with such humble beginnings, I think is really cool. It's just you know, you're looking through a viewfinder.
Well, yeah, and, you know, one of the adages that, you know, I've taught other photographers, because the trap that we get into as photographers, one more lens if I need, you know, that camera body, and I think a great phrase to live by, that it's not the arrow, but it's the Indian. You know, you can have all of the equipment, the quivers, the bows, the strings, but if you don't know how to pull it back and aim the arrow and develop your own technique and work within the resources that you have, it doesn't matter what you throw in your direction in the way of camera equipment. It just won't happen. In fact, there's just too much. I mean, you can take too much in the field. And I think that one of the great challenges is that, you know, to make whatever it is that you have, make that work for almost any application. You should be able to strap on an 80 millimeter lens and go out and, you know, do phenomenal work and, you know, develop that discipline there.
Because people listen to this from the internet, why don't we invite them at this point, if they wish, to go ahead and take a look at some of your images. So let's start with your website.
Yeah, there's a couple of different websites, but the new one that we just launched is called Seasons of Light Gallery. Plural, Seasons of Light Gallery. And a link to that is Mitchum Photography. So MITCHUM photography.com, and then that'll get you into the panoramics and the wildlife and so forth.
I think it's important for people to really see what you do. Then how did you progress at that point to say that you want to be a photographer? You know, you're going to snap kids, or what are you going to do? But let's talk a little bit how that developed.
Yeah, I mean, I disdain taking pictures of people. Unless it's my family or friends or something. That is unique for Matt. I have a good friend. He does portraiture work, and he does some of my bio stuff when I need someone to take it. And it's a different mindset, and, you know, I respect it, but it wasn't for me. I'm too hyper. I am not made for the studio. I've got way too much adrenaline going on, and I've got to be moving. And I like the challenge of landscape photography, so I'm very highly competitive. You'll read in my bio, you'll see my triathlete background and, you know, doing Ironman and 50-mile runs. And it's very consistent with my personality and the way that God has made me. And so that started my outdoor work, and that I always wanted to get up on another ridge. And then a little bit of the competitiveness is probably, it plays out into the photography, is that, you know, you're trying to capture something that, you know, people have never seen, or it's never been done before. And in today's world, where every household has a camera, that's a very difficult challenge. So, but I can take it personal, and, you know, say, you know, there's much to do in this world still, and what it means to nature. So that was step number one. And then the other step that, you know, allowed me to progress was, you know, just simply success. You know, I started being published, and people started taking a great interest in my work. People wanted to buy my prints, and I thought that was pretty cool, that somebody would want to put that on their wall and live with me, you know, not personally, but with an image that I took. And from there, it just opened up a whole, you know, bunch of, you know, new opportunities. And, you know, and then slowly, you know, it came to the point that after, you know, my stint with National Geographic, that I went exclusively into fine art print photography, you know, versus more of a documentary kind of work. And really, I wanted to have strong statements built around nature and landscape scenery that would really push and move people emotionally and practically to get involved either in the environment, and ideally both, and then, you know, to do interior decorating and, you know, promoting what we've got going on. And that's been really the core of our clients, you know, that they just love that theme and the colors and the subjects. So that was the second launching pad that kind of moved me into my photography. Moving it from a hobby to a business, that's a big deal. That's a real challenge, you know, to do that.
You mentioned that you worked with National Geographic, and there probably is no more wonderful mystique than the concept of being a National Geographic photographer. Tell us about how that came about. Photography is probably one of the most competitive businesses in the world. And not many people really get to the point that they can achieve levels that you have. How do you begin to work with National Geographic?
You know, Sydney, you're a good photographer. There's, like you said, there's many great photographers that are out there. From a technical standpoint, there's a lot more technical people than I am. And as far as success and, you know, making that connection and doing all of that, I just tell people it's dumb luck. You're just very fortunate. You know, you're in the right place at the right time, and it makes a connection. And then they go through your portfolio, and there needs to be depth, there needs to be strength, there needs to be uniqueness. So, but again, a lot of people have that. And then, you know, why is it that your number gets pushed versus someone else? It's just luck. And it's, you can't understand it. You know, it's like grace. You know, would God choose to use grace and work with one person and several people? And I mean, you never can figure that out. You know, it's a mystery. So I'm done trying to figure that one out. I'm thankful. But it came to the point that I turned them down so that, you know, they just don't pay anymore. So because of all of these other great photographers, there's no business anymore there. You know, for a family person, and, you know, if you want to own a home, and it's, you know, at that point, it's, you know, you got some big decisions you have to make. So that's what's so nice about being self-employed.
So what's it like trekking around the world, stalking the wonder with an eye to capture its life in a flash? We continue our talk with Jeff Mitchum when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.